So this talk is a little different than the first one I gave, and it's called Swimming Upstream: How Does a Catholic Live in a Pagan World? And the talk started when my parents got old. My dad died 10 years ago at 94 years old, and my mother died on Mother's Day of this year at 100 years old. So I got good genetics, I guess. And they had been married 73 years. And they were good Baptists. My dad and mom became Baptists in 1953 with the Billy Graham Crusade. And then they raised me that way. But my mom and dad, as they were getting older, I said, you know, we really ought to talk to them. I did write their stories, did a whole genealogy thing, but I wanted to just talk to them more about what they thought about life and the changes from when they were young until today. And my dad he was a very patriotic guy. We lived out in the country, and we always had the American flag flying. And it always had the light on it, and the flag was always there, and we never missed a 4th of July parade. And my dad loved all the patriotic songs that we would sing. But he made a surprising statement to me at that time that he didn't like his country anymore. And I said, Dad, you're one of the most patriotic guys I've ever known. What do you mean you don't like your country anymore? He said, Steve, I love America, and I love what it stands for. And I love what it was, but I don't like what it's becoming. And I said, talk to me more, tell me more. And him and my mom kind of divulged. It was a long conversation, and I'm just going to summarize it very quickly. The other two speakers have already talked a bit about it too, what's happening in our country today, especially Deacon Sivers. And my dad says, well, Steve, when we were young and your mother and I married, we expected to have children and raise our children. And if someone would have asked us back then, would you ever consider getting an abortion? My mother said, my first question would have been, what's an abortion? What is an abortion? And she said, we would have never dreamed of such an unthinkable thing being done to a baby in the mother's womb. We wanted children. Back when we were young in the early 1900s and the 1950s and so on, everybody wanted children. They were a gift. They were special. And my dad came from a family of 13. And my mother only had one sister, so she always wanted to have more family because she felt deprived with only one sister. So she said, we can't even begin to comprehend this idea of an abortion. She said, and then what happened is it became the law of the land in 1973 with the Roe versus Wade, and it became now the law of the land, and it was legal to kill your baby. And she said, then they said we had to pay for it in our taxes, and they expected us then to celebrate it as a wonderful thing, as a great freedom for women. She said, we don't like it, Steve. It's a horrible thing. Our country's going in the wrong direction. And then my dad said, and we know that there was probably always homosexuals, and you know, but it wasn't something you discussed in polite public, and nobody wanted to admit they were, and no one wanted to associate with them, and it was something that was not acceptable in polite society. It was an aberration from what the moral standards of the country and expectations were. And he said, and then the next thing we find out is that it's becoming acceptable. And then the Supreme Court says that a man and a man can get married, and they call it the same thing that happened when your mother and I got married. How can your mother and I getting married to have children to raise a family be the same thing as two guys or two girls? He said, and then, not only that, but now it becomes the law of the land that it's equal, and I have to respect it, and not only that, I have to celebrate it. And if I don't celebrate it, I'm a bigot. And so my parents were, and I could go on and on. This was a long conversation, but I think you get the point. That they realized that they were no longer in the same country that they were when they were younger. That they were raising their kids and seeing their grandkids raised in a world very different than they knew. Back when they were younger, it was a Christian country. And by that, I don't mean that everybody carried a Bible around and quoted John 3:16. It meant that everybody had the basic understanding that there was a God. We said the Pledge of Allegiance in school. I said the Pledge of Allegiance every day in school. I pledge of allegiance under God even. And we had prayers in school when I was a boy. Now you can't do any of those things anymore. And football players kneel when they hear the national anthem. And it's a whole different world coming, and it's different than what my parents knew. And so when they talked about that, I can't, in my mind, I put together a timeline. Because in the first 3 centuries of Christianity, it was also very pagan. The Greco-Roman world was very pagan. And then the early Christians converted the world, and it became a Christian world, the Western world did. And it had all the blessings of Christianity, and then 1700 years of Christianity. And then about 100 years ago, the third step in the timeline is somebody came up with the idea that there's a better philosophy than Christianity, and they got rid of God, and they got rid of morality, and now it was a pagan country again, and we're moving into that, and we're seeing it, and I'm going to make the point more as we go along. We Christians are now becoming part of a despised subculture. We're no longer our ideas and our absolute truth that we know, Christianity, is no longer accepted. And we are not buying into the new philosophy that's raging across the globe right now. We're resisting it, and we're saying, no, I can't buy into that. And so we are considered intolerant bigots. And we are seeing cancel culture. You're seeing churches being spray-painted, pregnancy centers being spray-painted. I was at a friend's house in South Carolina, Greenville. His name is Steve Wood. You may have heard him. He has a show called Faith and Family on EWTN, and he's got a website called dads.org. And he said, we're battening down the hatches because we're expecting to be attacked anytime soon because they are a Catholic ministry that stands up for traditional marriage and traditional view of human life. And he says, we're expecting to be attacked. We're building fences and we know it's going to come. And this is exactly what we are facing today. We as Catholics especially, because evangelicals don't stand out like we do. Our steeples go very high. And we have never compromised on what the morality is. Protestant churches, they're all over the map. I always say that Protestants, Americans choose their churches like they choose their restaurants. On Monday morning, we drive by Pizza Hut, Burger King, KFC, and McDonald's, and I say to my wife, what do you feel like? I feel like a pizza. Okay, we'll go in and get a pizza tomorrow. Maybe she'll feel like a hamburger. Sunday morning comes along, and we drive down Main Street, and there's Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Pentecostal, and I say to my wife, what do you feel like today? And she said, well, I feel like this church, so we go there. And if two men want to get married, there's a church down the road that'll take them and say, we have special blessings for you. And if you want to abort and contracept, don't worry, we're never going to meddle in your bedroom. You do what you want to do. We're just here to be happy, clappy Christians. So you have this whole attitude, but it's the Catholic Church that stands out because for 2,000 years we have been uncompromising on the value of human life, on the traditional view that God created a man and a woman to be married. And I'm not going to repeat everything Deacon said earlier because I agree with him, and I think both him and Jesse are right on in their approach. But we are now in a position where the world tells you to shut up. You are not allowed, even though they suppose they're the most tolerant of all. We need to have tolerance. You and I have lost the freedom of speech because we're not allowed. Keep your Christianity out of the marketplace. Keep your religion out of politics. Keep your religion out of the workplace. You can be a Christian in your men's groups and in your home and in your church, but when you step out of those places, shut up. And you know that's true, and it's getting worse and worse. Depends on what state you're in as well. But it's getting worse and worse. It's very difficult to be a Christian anywhere in the world today. Muslim countries are number one, the most dangerous, but communist countries too. Look at the masses of people in China that are being persecuted for being Christians, and atheistic country, and North Korea and all the others, and countries in Africa. Christians are being persecuted around the world. And I'm in the Middle East a lot, in the countries like Syria and Egypt and Jordan and Israel and those areas. Israel has freedom of religion, but everybody around them, it's very dangerous to be a Christian. And in our country now, we're losing that freedom. It is flipping on us so fast that it's almost inconceivable. We're being canceled. We're being quieted. We're being shut down. We're being persecuted. And it ain't going to get any better anytime soon. I tell my kids when they raise my grandchildren, I have 19 of them, and my grandchildren know I say this. I tell my kids, I want you to raise my grandchildren to be martyrs because they're not going to be raised in the same country I was raised in. and I want them to know that there's something worth dying for. And little Maria Faustina said, Grandpa, why do you want us all to die? I don't want you to die, Maria, but I want you to know there's something worth dying for. So in the parallels between, let me start out by this way. There's a lot of documents being written by the Vatican and bishops and synods about the new evangelization. Everybody's heard about it. The new evangelization, there's all these documents and books and synods and councils. How many of you have read all those? That's what I thought. Our bishop had written a document on the new evangelization, and I was at a men's conference just like this in Lansing, Michigan, and he was in the back. And I made the comment that all of those documents are unnecessary. I said, excuse me, bishop, but they're all unnecessary. He was not amused, but he understood why I said it as we went along. I said, because people don't read them much, and we don't need to come up with a blueprint or reinvent the wheel as to how to convert a pagan country to Christ, because the early Christians did it. They were in a pagan Roman Empire that had many gods called polytheism. They had infanticide. They killed people. There was no value to human life. Half the people in Rome were slaves. They were purchased and owned. They had all kinds of paganism, infant sacrifices. I could go on and on. And yet those early Christians in 300 years without Twitter and Facebook and CNN or Fox News or anything else, those early Christians, simple people, turned the whole world upside down for Jesus Christ in 300 short years. That's an amazing feat. With the powerful Roman armies and the powerful gods and all of the religions of Rome and all of these places, the early Christians quietly turned it upside down so that in 300 years, Christianity became legal and then shortly after became the religion of the empire. These Christians lived in a similar situation to what we're living in now, and it's going to get worse here. My proposal is how do we change our pagan culture? How do we live today as authentic Catholics in the midst of this culture that tells us to shut up or we're going to be persecuted? Very simply, we learn how to do it by going back and looking at how the very first Christians did it for 300 years. They had what was called polytheism. Many gods. Poly means many. Theos, God. And you go into the Pantheon today, one of the last of the great Roman buildings that's still standing there, but now it's a church. I love it. And you walk in, there's niches up there, and they had all the gods, Apollo, Zeus, Aphrodite, they're all up there. And they said, you know, you Christians, it's not a problem that you worship Christ. You just can't say he's the only one. And I'll tell you what we'll do. There's a niche that's open right there. We'll put Jesus in that niche. And you could come in and worship him with all the other gods. And then you'll be accepted in the Roman Empire. But the Christians said no. Because our creed says we believe in one Lord, Jesus Christ. And those are all false gods. And Paul told us in 1 Corinthians that behind every one of those gods is a demon. And we only worship the one living God. That's what got the Christians in trouble. That was their problem. That's why they got persecuted. And you and I are going to be in the same situation when we're going to say that we still believe in one Lord, Jesus Christ. And he's the Lord of heaven and earth. So today we don't have polytheism by that name, but we have something that's similar called pluralism. And that doesn't mean, I'm not saying that we should be critical of other cultures and languages and ways of dress, but what my point is that we now have the idea that pluralism, every religion, every philosophy, every idea is equal to every other. And don't you dare say that you have the truth. Who are you Catholics to say that you have the truth and that you have a corner on the truth and that the other religions and philosophies and atheism and all these things are wrong? Who are you to say that? Don't you know that we live in a relativistic society and we have agreed that everybody has their own truth and there is no such thing as truth anymore? Truth is relative, and Pope Benedict said that we live under the tyranny of relativism because relativism becomes a tyranny. And that's what we're experiencing today. So in 300 years, the Christians did it. Now, how did they do this? They weren't able to build churches. These folks were simple people. They were not the wealthy. They were not the nobles. They were not the big politicians. In fact, Paul tells you who these simple people were that were able to turn the world upside down for Jesus Christ. Who were they? Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he says this, consider your call, brethren. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise, and God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. In other words, those early Christians were guys just like us. They were families just like us. We're not the ones running the media. We're not the ones running the government. We're simple people that go out and work every day and have a living and raise a family and go to church on Sundays. We're simple people. We're not the intelligentsia and the media and the power of the world. And we're just like the early Christians. And if they could do it, we can do it. So the question is, how did they do it? And then we can find out how we can do the same thing today in our culture. They couldn't build churches because it was an illegal religion. If you built something and you built a church, the Romans would love it. They'd turn it into stables for their horses. They couldn't do door-to-door evangelism and hand out literature. They couldn't have open-air crusades like Billy Graham does or World Youth Day like we do as Catholics. You couldn't do that back in those days. And you certainly couldn't go picket the emperor's palace if you didn't like his policies. How did you evangelize? How did you do it if you were limited all of that? Well, most of them went to Mass quietly, but it was in homes. It was called Dominus Ecclesia in the Greek because it was, Dominus means home, Ecclesia is church. You couldn't go to buildings like this or to big churches. You would go to someone's home for Mass. And usually there would be someone wealthier and have a bigger villa on the outside of town. And they would say, we'll open our home. And they would live very dangerously by doing this. They would be sacrificing everything possibly. And they say, come to our house on Sunday morning. We'll have the divine liturgy there and the priests will be there. And two of you come from this direction and 5 minutes later a family come. Don't all come at once because they'll be suspected, and come quietly and we'll celebrate the Mass, and then we'll leave the same way, a few here and a few there over time, because we don't want to raise any suspicions. And they had their Masses together like that. They were often accused of being cannibals because they ate the flesh and drank the blood of some guy named Jesus. They were considered atheists because they didn't have any God. Where's their God? Every other religion, they had Zeus or they had Aphrodite in the center of their temples. They, Christians, have not that. They are atheists. They have no visible gods. And they were considered incestuous because those families get together and they love one another in that meeting. The Mass was secret back then. Nobody who was not initiated through baptism was allowed to come in. And so there were speculations that they were in there. They have the kiss. They kiss everyone during that meeting. And they love one another. Can you just imagine? Because they thought that we were doing the same thing they were doing in their religious situations. And so they would gather together, but they did still gather together. They did talk about Jesus to people, but how did they do it? They did it wisely. Let me give you an example. Imagine that I go to a bus stop and there's a bunch of people gathered and there's a man here and I walk over to him, just that never seen him before. I say, hello, sir. How are your kidneys today? What's he going to say? My kidneys are none of your damn business. My kidneys, how are you? You're a pervert. Get away from me. But now let's say that I find out he does have a problem, and at Christmas we take gifts and we take help him go to the hospital. We take him there for his treatments and we have 4th of July with him and we take food over when he's in the hospital. And a year later, I go to the same bus stop and the same guy's there and I walk up and ask the same question. Hello, sir. How are your kidneys this morning? What's going to be the different response? He's going to say, oh, thank you so much for asking. My kidneys are doing much better. The left kidney is still a problem, but the right. And he's going to go on and thank me for asking and showing a concern about his kidneys. Why? Because over the last year, I built a relationship with him. And in Protestantism, we called it relational evangelism, where you build relationships with people so that you earn the right to talk to them about what's important to you. And the early Christians did that. They gained the confidence of their neighbors. They served them. They took care of them. And then when they got an opportunity, they told them why they were doing these things. And they told them about Jesus and the church. And then people would come to Christ because of this personal relationship they built. They also had disciplined lives. They weren't like the Romans, many times profligate. Paul said, many of you were like them. You were homosexual. You were carousing. You were drunk. You were having orgies. But now you are in Christ. the early Christians walked away from their wild, profligate, sinful lifestyle and they began to live holy lives. And that was noticed by people. They also cared for the poor and the disadvantaged. Why? Because Christians had this idea that we were made in the image of God. Imagine that. God made us in His image. Therefore, He has His image stamped on every single one of our souls. We have an indelible mark of God on us, and our souls will live for eternity. When a child has a conception, the soul is given there by an act of God, and that person has an inestimable value, and they will live for all of eternity. So the Christians had a totally different view about the human person than the Romans and the Greeks did. So where you could have slaves and all of this, the Christians brought about a big change in that. The Christianity really changed the world when it began, when it brought Christianity after the first 300 years and it became legalized. Christianity is what brought about universities. Universities are a Christian, Catholic invention. The great art and music is Catholic. Look at Bach and Beethoven and all of the great musicians. This all came out of the Christian worldview. Hospitals and healthcare, even today, Catholics are the number one healthcare provider around the world because we believe that people are valuable and we need to help them like Jesus said that we should. The Christianity even brought equality for women. Most of the people today say that the church hates women and the church holds women down. It won't let them get abortions. It hates women. But it was the Catholic Church, it was Scripture and the Christian worldview that brought liberation for women. I'll give you an example. In the Roman times, a man owned his wife. A man had a wife, a legal wife for legal children, a concubine for a whole bunch of other children, and a mistress for pleasure on the side. And a lot of the Greeks and them also had a boy on the side. And the women were treated as almost property. They were under the authority and property of the men. And Paul, he writes in 1 Corinthians 7, and he writes what became an atomic bomb in the early century, the first century. Here's what he said. He said, "You women, do not withhold yourself from your husbands because they own your body." That was nothing new. The Romans already believed that. But then he reverses it and drops the atom bomb. "And men, do not deprive your wives of their sexual relations because they own your body." Paul says that the wife owned her husband's body. Can you imagine the atomic bomb that was going off in the first century, and that bomb just continued to go until women were also considered, like Paul said, there is neither male nor female. Neither slave nor free, we're all equal in Christ. That was a radical, radical change in culture and civilization when Paul sent that out and people began to be Christians and believe that. Didn't happen overnight, but Christianity revolutionized the world. And we in the West are still living with the capital that we earned as Christians. We're losing all of that freedoms now, but we're still living with the beauty of all of the things that Christianity brought. And the more you get away from Christianity, the less we'll have those beautiful things. They also believed that human life was of infinite value. So here's a letter that was written in the first century. A man was living in Rome. He went to Alexandria, Egypt, to find work. So he goes to Alexandria and he writes to his wife, "I am still in Alexandria. As soon as we receive our wages, I will send them to you. And if in the meantime, if by good fortune you give birth, if it's a boy, let it live. But if it's a girl, expose her." What does he mean, expose her? I'll read another quote. "When the Romans threw their unwanted newborn babies under the bridges, leaving the infants to be carried away by the wild dogs at night, the Christians waited in the shadows, took the children home and raised them as their own. And this testimony over a period of time won the hearts of many." They didn't have abortion like we do today with the stainless steel scalpels and the anesthesia and the things that we have today behind the walls of a Planned Parenthood or something. They would have to give birth to the baby usually, and then they would just infanticide. They'd throw it away under the bridges, especially the girls. People wanted boys. And the Christians would go save those babies because they said it doesn't matter if it's a girl or a boy, if it's a helpless infant, wanted or unwanted, the baby is made in the image of God and has such a value that we're going to raise them as our own. And the world, the Roman world, saw the Christians had the compassion. They saw that they cared for the poor and the unfortunate and the disabled and the elderly and even the newly born babies. And it had a huge impact on them. They realized that the Christians had something they didn't have. They knew their gods were mythical, but the Christians had a different way of life. I want to just talk about infant sacrifice, because cultures in all through history have had human sacrifice and even infant sacrifice. And you think, well, that's way back then. Not so, even 500 years ago only. South of our borders here in Mexico, the Aztec Indians, a great and marvelous and huge civilization of the Aztecs that were around the area of Mexico City, just south of our border. They say that one out of five babies was used as an infant sacrifice. And when they built their temple, which is where Mexico City is today, and when I take my groups down there, I give this talk at the temple where they did this. They said that in the Aztec language themselves, they said their name of their God was the lover of hearts and the drinker of blood, literally. And when they dedicated their temple in the Aztecs and Mexico City, where it is today, they slaughtered and sacrificed 80,600 men, human beings, to dedicate their temple. And they ate their hearts and they drank their blood. And they did it from the top of the temple, and the blood was running down the steps to the ground below to satisfy the bloodlust of their God. This was just 500 years ago, but it's been taking place a lot in human history. There were gods in biblical times, and I'm just going to explain this to you if you doubt that our country is really a pagan country. We got rid of Roe versus Wade. Yes, that was 50 years after it was implemented, but that doesn't stop what's happening. Our state right now, Michigan, is a sample state of what's going to try to happen around the world, around our country. That one law that was a national law was brought down by the Supreme Court, but now there's 50 new laws that are being passed or tried to be passed in 50 states. There's a war now in every state in this country. My state of Michigan is on the leading edge of the worst of the worst. Our Governor Granholm is unbelievable. She says, we're going to fight like hell to keep abortion. Our bishop came out and says, we're going to fight like hell to defeat you. She won, though, and they passed a law. It didn't just get into a new law, but they actually amended the Michigan Constitution with Proposal 3 that said that a woman can abort her baby even up to the moment of birth, and that a boy can be turned into a girl and a girl can be turned into a boy at 10 years old without parental permission or knowledge. And then the small print, it's even worse. And do you think that's not going to make you and I in big trouble? What happens if a doctor says, I'm not going to operate on that boy to remove his penis? You're going to get fired. You're going to get canceled. You're going to get whatever, put in prison. Because now it's enshrined in the law. And if anybody opposes that, you are a bigot. You are a criminal. You have hate speech. And they're going to come after us. Our state is on the cutting edge of the worst of the worst. I'm ashamed to say. We did everything we could to fight it. But the wave of this atheism and secularism is very powerful today, and the news media is all behind it. So let's say back in the days of in past days, there was a god called Moloch. And if you think this is a mythical god from the past, just go look on the internet and do a Moloch. He's coming back into vogue today in modern culture, in music and in other ways. Moloch, M-O-L-O-C-K-H. And Moloch was a big potbelly stove god, huge. There's pictures you can see on the internet of what it's like. And in my movie, Elijah and Elisha, I talk all about this. And I show these gods that were there during the times of Israel. And he had a big hole in his belly. And they would put wood and coals in there. And they'd start a fire on a Saturday morning, say. And he was a god that demanded infant sacrifice. And he was a fertility god, a god of nature. And he was the one that brought the rains and he brought prosperity and the crops would grow. These people were agrarian. They grew crops and they had animals. They had to have rain to survive. So Moloch was the one who brought that to them. But he demanded of them human sacrifice. You give me your best and I'll give you my best. And so they'd gather together on Saturday morning, say, for the great feast and the great sacrifice to Moloch. And they would bring their babies. And Moloch had hands like this. And it was iron. And when they get the fire going inside, it was so hot that these would all be red hot. You know how it is when they do with the anvil, they make horseshoes or whatever. And they would put the fire in and it would be shimmering with the heat. And then they would gather together in the morning of the great feast and sacrifice to Moloch. And the priest would say, you have a new baby and you have a new baby and you have a new baby. Please bring them forward. And the families would bring them up and they knew they were going to be heroes of the whole community because they were sacrificing their infant for the good of all the rest of you. And all of you would have rains and good crops because they were willing to sacrifice their infants. And they would bring them forward and the music would start and the drums would be going and the flute. And they were singing and dancing. It was like an orgy because it was all sexual. It was all dealing with fertility. And don't think our culture isn't getting all about things below the belt as well. And then they'd bring the children and the priest would lay the babies on the red hot, like a steak on a grill. Then they'd push the baby and he'd roll down into the belly and you wouldn't even hear the baby scream because of the music going. And then when the babies were all incinerated and the priest would step back and say, oh God, Moloch, we've given you our best. We pray now that you give us prosperity and rains and give us your best so that we'll be prosperous and happy for the coming year. Isn't that disgusting? And yet in America, we still worship the same God, Moloch. We've just given him a new name. His name is now abortion. And we Americans, not you, but many Americans, it is their high and holy sacrament. They will never give it up because for the secularist, it is their high and holy sacrament. And they offer their babies to the God abortion so that they can have more prosperity, so that they don't have to have the cost of another child to feed. Or maybe they just don't want to admit they made a mistake in the back seat of the van 6 months ago. And our country is every bit as pagan as the cities and the countries of old. In early Christianity, the Christians suffered under these kind of conditions, just like we're going to suffer under them as well. Jesus said when he went up into heaven, you will be my witnesses. Remember that? Do you know what the word witness is in Greek? It is martus. What English word do you think we get from martus? Martyr. Jesus said, you will be my martus. The catechism says some of us will be witnesses with our lips and some will be witnesses with our blood. When I get a chance to talk to seminarians, and I often do, especially in the Philippines and India, I've talked to hundreds of them at one time. I said to these young guys, don't think that you're coming to be a priest in order to have a career. This isn't a career. It's a love affair with the bride of Christ. And if you think that you're going to have a cozy life being a priest, think again, because it's going to be very dangerous to be a priest no matter where you become a priest in the world. And when that bishop puts the oil on your forehead, this doesn't just apply for India and the Philippines, it applies here too. When the priest puts that oil on your forehead and ordains you a priest, he's also going to paint a bullseye on your chest and you're going to become a target. And all of those young guys, I said, so if you're cowards, get up and leave now. And those young men all stood up as one and said, we're going nowhere. And I loved those guys. My grandson just went to 2 weeks ago to a vocation weekend to discern the priesthood. He thinks he wants to be a priest. And I told him, it's a dangerous career. By the way, if you think of his name as Damien, he's got something, autoimmune thing in his eye, and it looks like he's going to lose the vision of his eye and maybe the second one even too. He's only 18 years old, a handsome, beautiful young man who wants to be a priest. So pray for him. His name is Damien. Tertullian was an early Latin Christian theologian around 300 or so. And Tertullian made a very interesting comment. He said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. When the Romans brought the Christians in to persecute them and to kill them, they brought them into the arenas. The arena in Latin means sand. They would bring them in, they have white sand, and they would kill the Christians, and the blood would go into the sand, and everybody would go, more, more, because it was so dramatic. And it was like, kill them more. And Tertullian says, you bring us in and kill us in your arenas, but for every drop of blood that hits the ground, 10 more Christians will grow up out of the seed you just planted. It seems counterintuitive, because if I said I'm going to come here to Salem and we're going to start a new club and this is going to be a great club, but I guarantee that within 5 years, most of you will be killed for being a member of the club. How many of you are going to join that stupid club? And yet, that's what happened with this club. The new club called Christianity and the Catholic Church, the more people that were killed, the more the Romans joined, because the Romans knew their gods were mythical and they couldn't understand why Christians could die like that as martyrs. All they had to do was deny Christ and they could walk away, but they didn't. And so St. Augustine also says, the earth has been filled with the blood of the martyrs as with seed, and from that seed has sprung the crops of the church. The martyrs have preached Christ's cause more effectively when dead than when they were alive. They assert it today. They preach him today. Their tongues are silent, but their deeds echo around the world. They were arrested, bound in prison, brought to trial, tortured, burned at the stake, stoned to death, run through with swords, fed to the wild beasts and all kinds of death. They were jeered as worthless. But when their blood hit the ground, it was the seed for more Christians to grow up. Justin Martyr, he was a philosopher, a pagan philosopher. He wore the philosopher's pallium around the Roman Empire. And he became a Christian, Justin Martyr. Martyr's not his last name. It gives you a hint of how he died. And Justin Martyr said that one of the reasons he became a Christian is because he watched the Christians die. And he said, we Romans die very poorly. We scream, we curse, we try to avoid it. But the Christians, they pray hymns and sing hymns to their God. They take care of each other and they refuse to deny their Christ. They must know something we don't know. They have something we don't have. Our gods are mythical. They must know something, because they're really ready to, even under terrible conditions and persecution, they're ready to live for Christ. Not only that, they believe it to be so true, they're even willing to die for it, because they know they're going to be raised from the dead at the end. They have a belief in the resurrection. The early Christians had a different way of life. Now I'm going to put you in a position where I want to see how you would act in those first centuries when you saw other Christians die. Imagine now this room is full of Roman soldiers and they're surrounding this room and no one's going to leave because they've got their swords drawn at every door. And I am the emperor, I'm the centurion Licinius, and I come up and I say, gentlemen, we have a problem today. Because the city walls have been broken down and the enemies have been terrorizing us and robbing our country. They have no rains for a year. There's been no crops for a year. And we were at the city council trying to figure out why these things were happening. And we realized it's because Zeus is angry. Zeus is the king of all the gods. And he's the one that blesses our land with rain, and he's the one that protects our city walls, and all of these catastrophes are happening. Why has Zeus allowed this to happen? And we realize it's because guys like you have dissed him. How many of you were at the Zeus festival in July? See, because you didn't show up because you said Zeus is no god. Zeus is a false god, a demon even, and you worship this other, what you call him, Christos? You think you're Christians? So I am here today to rectify the situation. The magnanimity of Rome. What we're going to do today is appease Zeus. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to put an altar to Zeus here, a statue. And there's going to be coals, and I have incense here. All you have to do is come up and take a bit of the incense and pinch it and put it in the fire. The smoke will go up, and Zeus will see that you have now brought back your loyalties to him. And when you do this, the great magnanimity, I will have my secretary give you a libellium. You know what that is, of course. A libellium is a certificate that you are a Roman in good standing. And it will say your name and that you are a Roman in good standing and you can take it home. And when you get home tonight, your family will still be there. And on Monday morning, your job will still be there. We are very kind, but we need to appease Zeus. So now we have the statue set up. You can cross your fingers if you want. I don't care, but you have to come up and do this. So now I want, kind of like you do with your Eucharistia thing where you go row by row, I want you all to come up here now and burn incense to Caesar. Let's go. We'll start with you, sir. And you get the. I said, let's go. Maybe a couple would get up and go forward because they realize the implications. But then an older priest or a nun in the back would say, wait. Are you sure you want to go up there and burn incense to Zeus? Because remember, Jesus said, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father in heaven. And what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and to lose his own soul? Are you sure you want to take that risk? And then you go sit back down. Try to wait this out and see what happens. And I say, okay, I know how to deal with guys like you. Brutus! Brutus! And in steps the executioner. Brutus, the 250-pound executioner, ready to take care of you who refused to burn incense to Zeus. And now, with his sword drawn, I tell you that you have to get into one line or the other. You have 5 minutes and nobody leaves this room until you get into one line or this line. Burn incense to Zeus or meet my friend, Brutus. Ask yourself a question. If you were one of the early Christians in the first 300 years and this did happen to them, which line would you get into today? It's a scary thought. Thank you, Brutus. I gave this talk last night at the church and he heard it and he said, I'm bringing my sword tomorrow. I had a guy one time when I gave this talk, this big guy came running up the aisle. And when you're giving a talk, it's not a comfortable thing to have some guy run up the aisle at you. It takes you a pause. What's this? He ran up and he put his head down here and he said, cut off my head. I am a Christian. I'll never deny Jesus Christ. And there wasn't a dry eye in the room when he did that. I didn't plan that. He did that. It took me a few minutes to get my own composure before I could continue talking. But that was the situation that the early Christians experienced. And let me tell you something, had they not decided to even die for Christ and to pay that price, you would not be here today. They paid the price that kept Christianity alive during that pagan culture. It kept their religion alive until it succeeded in becoming the religion of the land. And we could be in the very same, if not us, our grandchildren, where we are going to have to maybe suffer the same thing in order to keep Christianity alive for the next generation. It's happening in many parts of the world now. We still live in a bubble of freedom here. So I want to just tell three stories real quick. Thank you very much. I'm glad I still have my head. That was cool. Every time I give the talk, I want you to come. Yeah, I'm going to give three quick stories. I think I'm still okay on time. Am I okay? Do I have to quit? 5 more minutes? I could do it in 5 minutes. Okay. The same story with the sword happened when I was asked to be a sponsor for a young man who had become Catholic, and I asked me if I would prepare him for CCD. And I said, no, I'm too busy. I can't do it. So they said, well, would you meet with him one night? I said, okay, I'll meet with him one night. My point of this is we need to teach our young people what it really means to be a Catholic today. It doesn't mean just wearing a white dress and a suit with a bow tie and having a nice party after you have your CCD classes and you're confirmed. In order to be a Christian today, these kids need to know that this is dangerous business they're getting into, just like the Jewish boys who have always through history been willing to lay down their life for the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to confirm their Judaism through their bar mitzvahs. And so this boy, maybe we need to do these kind of things with our kids to emphasize it. But this boy, they said, I'll bring him over Wednesday night. I said, okay, good. So what I did is I just bought a Roman helmet for the movie that I made on the Apostolic Fathers, the first guys who died this way. We filmed their whole life on location. And I had bought a sword just like the one you had. And my wife pinned a red blanket over my shoulder, and I went and I hid in the shadows of my front porch with the Roman helmet, the sword, and the red. I looked like a centurion with a big red brush on top. And I hid in the front porch in the shadows, and that boy came up the stairs. And as he came up the stairs, that 12-year-old Matthew, as soon as he got up to the top of the stairs, I jumped out of the shadows, I pulled the sword out, and I pushed that kid against the wall, the bricks of my porch, and I said, Matthew, are you ready to die for Jesus Christ right now? If not, you're not ready to be confirmed. Don't waste my time. I'm a busy man, Matthew. And he goes, I will, I can, I do. And his parents, you should have seen him in the car, their eyes got big. Oh, what do we get our kid into? And I brought that boy into the house, and I talked to him for 3 hours about what it meant to be a Christian and to be confirmed. And if you're not ready to die for Jesus, you're not ready to be confirmed, because you receive the Holy Spirit so that you're ready to live a life for Jesus, to really live it and to even die for it if you have to. That kid went out of that house all excited. He told everybody for a year, his parents said, he told everybody about Steve Ray and the sword and what it means to be a Catholic. But this is, I think, what we need to do with our kids. We need to emphasize with them what Christianity really is. It's not this country club that we join and go to the meetings on Sunday morning. It's a lifestyle, and it may get us killed. The next second story is my son had, we had a big pool. It was 20 feet across, one of those cheap ones, you know, above the ground and around. And so my son said to the kids, if we go in there and we go around and around, we can make a whirlpool. He had something in mind he wanted to teach them. So he said, if we go, let's go around and around. Dad said, Dad, that's not going to happen. He says, yes, yes, if we all go around and around, it creates a whirlpool and the water goes down in the middle and it splashes out on the side. It's very, no, Dad, come on, let's go. So they get in the pool and they start going around. It was hard, but they got this great whirlpool going. And it's going around, and the kids thought it was great. And my son said, okay, now let's pretend this is the world. This is the current of the world, modern day America. And it's trying to tell us we have to go with the current. It's not giving us the option. It's saying you have to flow with us. And we have to go, and we have to accept abortion and LGBT and atheism and tolerance and all this stuff that's going on in our country today. And the world's trying to pull us along with it. The media, the news, the movies, everything is pulling us along. But let's say that we're not going to let the world tell us how to live. We're going to turn around and we're going to swim upstream. And now you know how this movie got its title. Let's turn around and swim upstream. And let's go against the tide. Because only dead things float downstream. So they all turned around and they started going the other way, and it was hard. This was a great whirlpool going, and there was a lot of motion, and the kids had it almost impossible. They were hanging on, trying to pull, and it was hard. And little Sammy said, I can't go anymore. I'm tired. I'm tired. And Maria Faustina said, swim, Sammy, swim. You don't want to go to hell, Sammy. Keep swimming. And they got that thing going after a while, going the other way. And my son said, see, guys, if we work hard enough and if we go against the stream and we really fight and we really believe and we start going against the current of the modern culture, we can turn it around. And I give this talk all over, challenging men and everybody else. I can't do it myself, but if all of us start going in that pool and swimming against it and going counterculture and being vocal about it and doing what we can do in our own realm of influence, we too can turn the world around. And that's the new evangelization. It's not reading documents. It's really, really living for Jesus Christ. The last story is I realized that I have to talk to people. I have to present this to people. I can't just be silent in my own little protected world and be canceled by my own choice. And I was laying in bed and I thought of the day the judgment comes and I stand before God and I hear my name and I step into the throne room and there's God and he says, Steve Ray, let's see if your name is in the book of life. Ah, yes, R-A-Y, here you are. Welcome into the joy of the Lord, thou good and faithful servant. And these angels open the door over here and the door, they come out to greet me and I hear smells and sounds and music from the doorway. I can't believe. And I'm so happy. I start going with them, but then I hear Jim Smith. And that's the next guy called to be judged by God. And I said, wait a minute, to the angels, just a minute. That's my friend, Jim Smith. He sat next to me at the cubicle at work for 30 years. I know this guy. We had 4th of July together every year and we did things as a family. And so Jim Smith comes out and I'm all excited to see what happens to Jim. And God says, let's see if your name's in the book of life. I'm sorry, Jim Smith, your name is not in the book of life. And if you don't think this is going to happen, read the last few chapters of Revelation. There is a book of life, and your name better be in it at the final judgment. And angels from this side, creatures with hooks on their wings, horrendous beings, start to take my friend Jim over to this door. And Jim sees that he's going into a horrible place and he sees where I'm going. He says, wait a minute. Steve Ray, why are you going in that door and I'm going in this door? I said, well, Jim, it's because I was a Christian. I gave my life to Jesus Christ. I was baptized, confirmed. I lived for Jesus. And when I sinned, I went to confession. I got it right. And I lived a faith in Christ. And he says, wait a minute. You mean you knew all of this and you never told me? You sat with me for 30 years and you never told me about this? And I said, Jim, I didn't want to impose my morality on you. I didn't want to insult your intelligence and think I can impose my views on you. I was being politically correct. I was being ecumenically sensitive. And Jim says, I can't believe that you say you're my friend and you never told me about this. And the last words I'm going to hear from my word, Jim, is, damn you, Steve Ray. And I've committed my life, and our family has, that no one's going to say, damn you, Steve Ray, at the end of time. I may do it well or not so well, but I am going to be a person who talks about Jesus and his church to people whenever I can. Nobody's going to tell me to shut up. I'm a Christian and I still live in a land with free speech. And I'm going to use it. And if we don't use it, we're going to lose it. I wear this cross everywhere, not because I wear jewelry. I'm not a jewelry kind of guy. But I wear it because every day it starts a conversation. It's a way that I can talk to people. I made up my mind that I'm going to talk to 3 people every day about Jesus one way or another. Even if it's just to say something or do something, like I was in the airport and there's kids behind me with a family and I hate being in a line. I like being first. I heard the kids squabbling and I bit my tongue and went totally contrary to my personality. I says, ma'am, would you and your family like to get up first? I'll get behind you. And she said, oh, thank you so much. And I held up my cross and I said, if I don't practice it, I shouldn't wear it. She said, thank you very much. And she went away with a very good thought of Christians in her mind. No one's going to, in any time soon, condemn Christians in her view because she heard as a young atheist at the airport. Most of my stories are at airports. He's a 30-some-year-old and he came up and said, oh, that's beautiful. I said, well, thank you. This is my standard reply. Thank you very much. I wear it proudly as a Catholic. He said, oh, so you believe it? I said, yes, I believe it enough to die for it. And he goes, oh, I got to do it. And he walked away. He ended up sitting next to me on the airplane. I'm not kidding you. My wife and I call this divine appointments. We're in the air. I feel a tap on my shoulder. He said, you really believe that, don't you? Or this? I said, yes, I do. He said, I don't believe in anything, and I would love to have something to believe in. Would you tell me why I should be a Christian? And I had him for 2 hours. Only because I wore this almost every single day. I've had so many guys say, Steve, I've worn a cross my whole life, but starting today, I'm wearing it out. We need to confront our world. We need to be involved in the political process. We need to be involved in our churches. The church has become feminized. Men need to get back into their position and claim their rightful place in the church and in the family and in the world. And we need to reclaim it for Jesus Christ. Thank you very much, and God bless you.